And what happens in this chapter centers the other people with Jezebel, with God, and then with Elisha. And each interaction has something surprising about them. The characters don't seem to react or do the things that you might expect them to do. It doesn't seem to add up. So what we'll do this morning is take each in turn, try to work out what the author is trying to say to his readers before we then think about how it applies to us. So firstly, Elijah and Jezebel. So Ahab has just witnessed these extraordinary events on top of Mount Carmel. He returns to the palace, and like you would if you just witnessed something incredible, he tells his wife about it. The God of Israel has revealed himself to be the true God. That's, after all, what's happened on top of Mount Carmel, isn't it? But that's not what Jezebel takes from it. Rather, in a rage because of what has happened to the prophets of Baal, she sends a note to Elijah saying this, verse 2, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." This is a threat, a death threat. How's the prophet going to respond to this? Remember, this is the same man who's just stood before 900 prophets on top of Mount Carmel, who has seen God do the most extraordinary of things, proving himself to be the one true God, a God who Elijah can trust to do the impossible. But what we read in verse 3 is shocking. Elijah was afraid, and he ran for his life. Now, this is so strange that basically none of the commentators that I have read agree on what is going on here. Some present Elijah in an extremely positive light. Some paint him in an extremely negative light. So to be honest, they haven't been that helpful in working out what's going on here. But let's just stick to the facts. Elijah is scared. He is. That's what it says. Elijah was afraid. He's scared, and that's why he runs. And although he runs for his life, well, he's not scared of dying, is he? In fact, in the very next verse, he asks that God will let him die. So what's going on here? Why would he do this? Well, what we read further on, I think, helps us. In verse 9, Elijah is asked why he is where he is. And in verse 10, he gives this answer. He says, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." Now, this indicates something to us that is implied in Jezebel's death threat. What has happened on Mount Carmel, this incredible event, a very visual of visual proclamation by God of who he is, well, it's not had the desired impact. Israel will continue to worship Baal, even though he's proven to not be God. Why? Well, because although Ahab is the king, it's his wife who wields his royal authority. It's Jezebel. And as long as that is the case, she is very clear in her death threat. She will do everything that she can to stop Israel from worshiping Yahweh. So why is Elijah afraid? Well, think again about the high that he's just come off. The very thing which he's been striving to do has been achieved. Yahweh has proven himself once and for all to be God. But what happens with this death threat is that his entire world comes crashing around him. With her note, Jezebel is saying, as loudly as she possibly can, I don't care. I don't care. Nothing is changing. Now, if that happened to you, what's it going to do to you? Was it not going to be incredibly demoralizing? Is it not going to bring you to the point of despair? And when that happens, boldness disappears. This is why Elijah runs. This is why he asks God to die. He thinks he's failed. So how does God respond to Elijah? Look at verse 5. All at once an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. And the same thing happens in verse 7, and there we are told that he needs the food because the journey is too much for him. What's God doing? He's providing for Elijah's physical needs so that he will be able to go where he wants him to go, which in this instance is the mountain of God, Mount Horeb, which is known to us more commonly as Mount Sinai, which of course is the place where God made a covenant with Moses, and Moses is given the book of the law. Now, we'll come back to that. That is significant. But before we do that, note that as well as feeding him and guiding him, God is saying with his actions towards him, I'm not done with you, Elijah. God is comforting Elijah, telling him that this perceived failure that he thinks that he's had does not mean that he no longer has purpose. God still wants him. God still wants to use him. So he takes him to Mount Horeb, this most significant of places in Israel's history, and he asks him a question. Verse 9, what are you doing here, Elijah? Now, this is not a reproach. Remember, God's led him here. And he's led him here to do as Moses did, to commune with God. So what's his response again? Verse 10, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left. And now they are trying to kill me too. Now, this is not a why has this happened to me sort of statement. He is stating what he believes to be the facts. He's been very zealous for God. He has. He was incredibly bold standing on top of that mountain against, well, everyone, 900 prophets, the king. And what Elijah then says to us shows us why God brings him back to the mountain where the covenant was given. He brings him to the mountain because he's highlighting the fact that Israel have broken the covenant with him. And Elijah also uses this as an opportunity to unburden himself, to express how he's feeling. Feeling like he's the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. What happens next is the most famous part of our story. There is a gale, an earthquake, and a fire. But notice what God says before that happens. Verse 11, he says, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Now, this is exactly what happened to Moses before he received the law in the first place. And then we have the gale, we have the earthquake, we have the fire, and three times we were told that the Lord was not in them. Then in verse 12 we read, and after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Now, this is perhaps not what we might expect. given what God has just done on top of Mount Carmel, one of the most dramatic ways that God could reveal himself. And therefore, we might expect him to have been in this great wind, or to have been in an earthquake, or to have been in the fire. But instead, he speaks in a gentle whisper. So what's God trying to communicate to Elijah here? Again, a lot has been written about this, but I think the simplest explanation of what is happening is that God is showing him how he frequently speaks. He doesn't always speak in audacious acts for entire nations to see, but more frequently, he speaks under the radar, behind the scenes, and as in this case, he speaks personally to his people. It may not seem like this has any impact on Elijah at all, because he repeats exactly the same response when God asks the question a second time. However, what follows suggests that there has been an impact on him, because God sends him to the desert and he goes. There's no questions. He ups and he goes. And bear in mind, this is a man who's just asked to die, feeling himself a failure. But his encounter with God, who speaks personally to him, has filled him with purpose again. And off he goes to do what God asks. So, Elijah and Elisha. He's called to go to this desert to do three things. Verse 15. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as a prophet. So Elijah is to anoint two new kings and a successor for himself. But why? What's the purpose? Verse 17. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him. So here's an example of what he's just declared to Elijah. How God works under the radar. Because what Elijah is being charged with is to anoint two kings who are going to bring about victory over Baal worship. God doesn't send a thunderbolt from heaven. He raises up other rulers to do his bidding, whether they realize that that's what they're doing or not. And as we often see with judgment in the Old Testament, it is laced with grace. He keeps 7,000 for himself, the remnant of faithful Jews whose entire nation has turned away from God. He doesn't drop them. He saves them. Elijah is not on his own after all. But the strangest part of this section is the calling of Elisha. He follows Elijah, but he realizes he wants to go back and say goodbye to his father and mother. And when he goes back, we read this in verse 21. So Elisha left him and went back. He took his yoke of oxen and slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah and became his servant. Now, of course, we would be quite easily understand why he would go back to say goodbye to his parents. But why kill the animals? Why burn the plow? Well, Elisha is symbolically putting to death his old way of life. He's saying, I'm not going to live in the relative comfort of farming anymore. He had 12 yoke of oxen. That would have been a lot back then. That means that he is relatively well off. So he's going to leave that comfort, and he's going to do what God wants him to do. He recognizes the finality of that commitment. Being a prophet isn't a walk in the park. He knew the risks. He was taking a big risk with his life, especially when Jezebel is still wielding kingly authority. She'd killed all of the prophets, most of the prophets. He knew the likelihood was that he wouldn't see his parents again. He knew the likelihood was that he wouldn't be able to come back and plow again anyway. So what does he do? He gets rid of it. He gets rid of it all. So what do we take away from this? I wonder if you've ever heard someone say something like this: I would believe in God if he just speak to me clearly. Now, this communicates something of the thought of our age. If something can be proved to be true, like, for example, gravity, then, well, I'll believe in it. And our culture, our age, prides itself on this reason. It likes to think that it's the thing that controls what we do, what we say, and what we believe. But this passage shows us that that is not the case. Ahab, as we have seen, had seen everything that had happened on top of Mount Carmel. He can be in no doubt that God has revealed himself as God. His wife is told everything, and instead of renouncing Baal worship, she holds on to the fact that the prophets have been killed. Now, why does she do this? Well, Dale Ralph Davis says this. He says, there was a blaze of light on Mount Carmel, but unless Yahweh grants internal light to see his external light, the darkness remains. Unless Yahweh grants internal light to see his external light, the darkness remains. There's a temptation to think that if only we can prove that God exists, all those who don't know Christ will become Christians. Maybe we even wonder, why doesn't God just send some lightning bolts from heaven to show us, to show the world that he is God? Why does he make evangelism such a slog for us? But this goes along with culture's idea that reason dictates what we do, but it doesn't dictate what we do. Think for a moment about a pregnant woman. A pregnant woman with strange cravings. Now say it's like my mother when she was pregnant with me and you crave slices of cucumber with a slab of whole grain mustard on top. Now my mom knew that was disgusting, but her desire for that cucumber and that mustard was so strong, it won the battle with reason and she eat it. And this happens so frequently all around us. And with regard to God, even if God did do incredibly miraculous things in Carlisle, there's absolutely no guarantee that your friend or your family member will come to Christ. The key to conversion is that internal light, the unveiling of our eyes, God's Spirit taking the veil off, switching the light on. Now, of course, we should hone our skills in defending Christianity because God will use that to help some come to faith. Of course, we should pray that God will do miraculous things in our city because that will help others see who he is. But above all, we need to pray that God will flick that switch, that the light will go on, that they will have that internal light so that they can see who Jesus is, the light of the world. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think this passage does, it gives us much hope if we feel ourselves to be failures or we feel like our usefulness as Christians is at an end. Here's Elijah just coming off the biggest high of his life, and his heart just must drop when he gets this message from Jezebel. It's made no difference. I've wasted my time. He feels like he's failed in his task. He feels useless before God. But God lets him rest, lets him recover from all of this emotional, physical, spiritual energy he's been expending for God. Then he shows Elijah that he is a God who often works under the radar, and then he commissions him to do what he wants. As I've been thinking about this part of the passage, two sets of people have come into my mind. First, it's the empty nesters, or those whose children have gone, are just about to go off to university. Now, one of the major things that God has given to you to do has been to raise your children. But that is about to become, or has already become, a lot less hands-on. No longer eating with 3, 4, 5 people around your table every night. You're down to just the two of you. You're no longer waiting for your children to get ready in the mornings. You're no longer driving them around the city to the different activities that they're involved in. What you've known for 18 plus years is at an end, and it won't be the same again. This is a major life change. This is just as big a life change, really, as having the child in the first place. Now, of course, you don't stop being parents, but it's different. And just like you had to work out what it meant to be a mother or a father, you need to work out how this changes who you are. And for some of us, there's such a sense of identity in being a mother or a father that we kind of lose who we are a little bit. But what this passage shows us is that you still matter to God. You still have purpose for God. You still have a part to play in His mission. And perhaps even this morning, He's calling you to take up something new here in the church. But notice as well that Elijah needed that period of rest and recovery. He needs to be fed. He needs to sleep before the journey and the action. And perhaps for some of you empty nesters, that's where you're at the minute. God is preparing you for the work He has, for the next part of the journey. And the second group of people are those who are a little older, who are a little grayer around the ears, maybe who've retired after 40 years of hard work. This passage says to us that we can never retire from God's work. That's a job that we do until the day we die. Yes, of course, what we might be able to do might change, because our bones are a little bit creakier, or we don't have the same levels of energy we had. But to be frank, we'll know when our work is done, because we won't be here anymore. Again, it's about working out, where is your place in God's kingdom? Where's your place in this church? What is God calling you to do? And again, maybe you need that period of rest, of recovery. God needs to prepare you for the work ahead of you. But there is work to do. And yet again, I think that this part of this passage speaks again to us as where we are at as a church. At the weekend away, and I think I shared it here the week after, I felt quite strongly that God was telling me to take the seatbelt off, to embrace all of what it meant to be a leader. And after I said that, in the afternoon, someone came up to me and said how they felt that was right for the church, that it was right for the seatbelt to come off. But that actually, up until that point, the seatbelt had been required, that the church was not ready to move forward. That stability was needed because of those difficulties that we had as a church. Elijah needed time to rest and recover for his journey, and I think for some of us, we needed that too. But now God is calling us to go on a journey, go on to the next place. And interestingly, this week I had another email from our friend Kevin McStay, who has had another dream about Hebron this week. He's becoming Hebron's prophet. In his letter, he said this. He said, "The present move of God will challenge and change. There will be those that respond excitedly and those who respond more slowly, but there will also be those who don't want to change, whose hearts are set against it." Now, change is hard. Let's not beat around the bush. It's hard, and sometimes it's painful. Sometimes, often, it's not what you want to do at all. And that's because it takes us out of our comfort zones. It takes us out of the places of safety. But be clear, when you read through the New Testament, what we see consistently over and over and over again is that when the Spirit of God is on the move, that's exactly what happens. They're taken out of their comfort zone. They're taken out of their places of safety. And the question is, how are we going to respond? Are we ready to take the journey of change that God has prepared for us? Some of us will respond excitedly. Some of us will respond more slowly, but that's okay. What we need to work on is if our hearts are set against that change. Then the most famous part of this passage has something to say too. The way God acts doesn't change. He is in these big showy things like what happened on Mount Carmel, but he's also in this gentle whisper. He frequently works in the unspectacular, in behind the scenes. And I think as a church, God's been pretty clear with us over the last 6 weeks. It's been wonderful to have had that clarity, and we should continue to enjoy it as long as it continues. However, history of the Bible suggests that God doesn't always speak this clearly. Sometimes we will have to strain to hear him. And when this happens, whenever it happens, don't be discouraged. He hasn't forgotten about us. He still wants us to pursue him. He's still calling us to do the things in his name that he wants us to do. Some may be spectacular. Most probably won't be. But all, if obedient to his request, will be for his glory. Then finally, think about Elisha. How he puts to death his former life. He cuts all ties with what he has been in order to follow God. And as I read this week, my mind was drawn forward into Matthew's gospel, those famous words that Jesus says in chapter 16, verse 24. He says, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what we have done." Now, what we've been hearing for weeks from God is that he wants our whole hearts. He wants wholehearted devotion to himself. And when that happens, when we do that, it involves sacrifice because it changes our worldview. It takes us away from living for ourselves and brings us to living for God. It takes us out of comfort and takes us towards struggle. That's why we have all of these illustrations in the New Testament of running a race, of striving every muscle, every sinew to move forward to what God wants from us. Following Jesus is costly. It costs us some of the things that we desire most in our lives, but the beauty of the gospel is that it gives us more than we ever thought possible. So as we close, let's think through some of these things with some questions. And I just add now, as a side note, on the first Sunday of the month, we talked this morning about how God's calling us to move forward. We're going to share, the elders are going to share how we feel God is calling us to move forward on that Sunday. So be there for that. But some questions for us to consider as we close. Am I devoted to praying that God will work by His Spirit in the lives of those who don't yet know Him? Do I need to come to God to be restored? Where's my place in the body? What is God's desire for me? Am I ready to take the journey of change that God is calling us on? Am I prepared for obedience when God's voice is not quite so obvious? And finally, what might God be calling me to put to death in my life this morning? Let's think through these things, and then Richard will come up and lead us in a final song, and I'll pray to close.